Okay, so you guys know what this is about. I've been asked to participate in this chair training program that the FPC put together to try and help chairs to do, you know, hopefully a better job at chairing and having the tools and information they need to be, you know, good chairs and productive chairs. So I ended up selecting the part that deals with focus and productivity. For better and for worse, I seem to have gained the reputation of being pretty good, at least from that point of view, as a chair. So on slide number two, I just give a little bit of information about myself in case there are people who don't know me. I've been around the standards arena for quite a while. Most of my career now has been dedicated to standards and open source. And I'm actually a former DirectVG staff member. I was there as I was actually only an employee for like 2 years, but it seems like it was much longer because I only changed hat by joining IBM later on and still continued to work with DirectVC. And so I was involved in many different standards activities, and today I'm actually chair or co-chair of no less than 3 different working groups, and I'm also the IBM CRM. So I have quite a bit of, you know, experience with DirectVC, we can say. So moving to slide number 3, I thought, you know, before you talk about all the things you should do, we should talk about the challenges that we face as chair and in the environment of the DirectVC and chairing working groups. I think the first one is the rigor of the DirectVC process. I've been involved with different organizations, and I can guarantee you the DirectVC is very rigorous. I think that's what, you know, makes it so valuable. The DirectVC goes to a great extent to make sure that the standards that they deliver actually, you know, represent consensus in the community, that, you know, the outreach is really big. It's not just the working group members, it's the community at large, the web being, you know, important to the planet, you know, overall. It means that we're dealing with a huge audience, and the DirectVC really goes to a great extent to try and include everybody in this process. Of course, that means it's very hard. It's much harder to agree with the rest of the planet than it is to agree with just a set of people that you've decided to work with. There is, you know, some of the challenges to do with historical expectation or expectation set by the history of the DirectVC and how things went. And one thing that is pretty clear to me is that there is this notion that people think that, you know, things take always more time than was chartered, and it's okay. And, you know, you see people in some working groups that just have no consideration whatsoever with deadlines and timelines, and we have to kind of fight that as chair to try and keep the working group on schedule and, you know, then pay attention to the timeline. And I think the DirectVC, led by Jeff Jaffe, has actually put a focus on this, and I thank him for this. I think it's important to try and do better at this. As I said, we're dealing with a huge community. It also means that people come with very different expectations, different backgrounds, and it's both a great asset, but it also, you know, makes it much more challenging when people sometimes have a hard time even talking. Simple language. We often talk about languages and time zone differences, etc. It's definitely much harder to do that. They are, you know, as I talked about, consensus is also difficult. There are plenty of organizations out there that work by simple majority vote. And as soon as there is a decision that needs to be made, you hold the vote and the decision is what it is and you move on. DirectVC tries to get a consensus, and I'll get back to that a bit later, but it's definitely much harder and it takes more time. As chair, one of the biggest challenges that you really have is that you're basically a manager, you're leading a group of people, but you have neither sticks nor carrots. You cannot give bonus when people do a good job or you want to thank them in any way. You cannot, you know, also threaten to fire them or, you know, have some kind of action, negative action against them. So that means, you know, you need to find other ways to kind of foster an environment where people want to contribute and help and work with you. There is also a lot of co-chairing going on. It can be both a blessing and a curse. There is definitely an overhead in having to work with other people. So it's the same is true for co-chairs. At the same time, it's kind of a relief to be able to not maybe chair an entire two-day meeting or, you know, to be able to sit back at some point and let other people drive the discussion. So there's a trade-off there. And then, you know, we are dealing a lot with the W3C team and, you know, this is a human organization and sometimes it goes well, sometimes it doesn't go so well. And depending on the individual's user experience may vary. So all of these represent a set of challenges that we have to deal with and that kind of impair, you know, your goal of trying to deliver the specification you're supposed to deliver in the right amount of time. So moving on to slide number 4, process. I'm not going to get into the detail of the W3C process. My main point really here is that as chair, you are responsible for ensuring, you know, the process is being followed and implemented properly. And it means you have to be very knowledgeable about the process because you'll find yourself having to educate the working group a lot about this, especially when you start with a new working group where there's a lot of new members, some of which may have no experience with standards whatsoever, some of which have experience with standards organizations that function quite differently. And so as chair, with help from the team, you know, the team contact especially, you can, you have to educate people and ensure that you're following the process. So this part is very important. And, you know, I spend a lot of time on calls and meetings explaining to people what is the next stage on the recommendation track, what is expected from us, what we have to do. People need to understand all of that. And as chair, you're the leader, you have to do that. On slide number 5, it's a similar slide. It's about the tools. I see a lot of time being spent on trying to figure out how to tell something to, you know, Zakim, getting Zakim to do something, to how to record an action. This is a lot of time that is wasted sometimes on calls or during meetings. And as chair, again, you're the leader. You should be able to help people figure things out and do a lot of education. And it's not always easy. And, you know, you're a person like everybody else, and some of us get to become chair with that necessarily an extensive experience in all these aspects of the W3C. But, you know, you need to educate yourself, invest your time into learning all these things so you can do a better job and help your working group members do a better job. At the end of the day, your team contact is your best friend. And, you know, again, if you're missing information, you should turn to them. Whether they know the information or not, at least it's their responsibility to get it to you if they don't have it. So moving to slide number 6, keeping working group in scope. So, you know, there's the this is a very important aspect. So there's a guide on the role of the group of chair, and it gives a very important aspect of the role of chair, which is to actually keep the working group in scope. Discussions can often go completely off track, and it's your responsibility as chair to keep the discussion focused. And I'll get back to this when the conducting meetings later, but this is a very important aspect that chairs, you know, have the responsibility for. So the charter obviously sets a first scope for the working group. It defines typically, you know, a list of deliverables that gives you an idea of what the working group is supposed to do, but it's not enough. Charters often are kind of like open-ended, more or less depending on the case, but it's your responsibility to keep the working group on track, to, you know, deliver on the deliverables set by the charter, and to try, as you the working group progress, to further define the scope. So, for instance, most working groups, you know, have a deliverable of defining use cases and requirements, which I find is a very useful exercise. And it's the kind of things that often working groups don't really care to do. It's kind of the thing you do. It's a bit like test suite. Developers don't really want to make them, but you have to do it, so you do it. But there's really a good reason to do this. And my experience, defining use cases and requirements early on in the working group has several advantages. The first one is it helps further define the problem. And as I say on the side, it's very hard to solve a problem that is not well defined. But it also has other aspects that I actually find very interesting, one of which is to define a common terminology. As I said earlier, working groups start, they have people from very different backgrounds joining, they have different mindsets, different expectations as to what this working group is really about. And they come with their own background and terminology, and just having a simple discussion sometimes takes a lot of time because people don't understand each other. They say words, they use terms that mean different things based on their context, their background. And going through the use case and requirements development, I find, help, sort this out early on. And all of this will benefit the working group moving forward to actually come up with a solution. One aspect that I also found worked really well is to develop a wish list. Because here's what typically happens. There is general agreement on what the use case and requirements are, and then you start developing a specification, and then invariably somebody says, oh, but I also need to be able to do this, and what about that? And they come up with other needs that are maybe, you can argue that it's in the requirements somehow, but maybe it's on the edge. And then, if you let that happen, you have scope creep, and the specification keeps increasing in size, which means more work, more time to review, and et cetera. And it's very hard for people not to, have their needs being addressed, because that's what they participate in the working group in the first place. One, kind of a relief valve is to have a wish list. All it takes is you create a wiki page on your wiki, and you say, we're not going to be able to do that this time around, but we can put that on the wish list so that at the end, when we are done with this version of the specification, we can look at our wish list and see the things we want to tackle the next version. And the simple fact that you put that on the wish list is much easier for people to accept that you're not going to address their needs now, because at least they have, the hope that first they are being acknowledged, their needs are being acknowledged, which psychologically is a very key point. And then, as I said, it also in the end gives them the hope that, it'll be done later. And when you do get to the end of your charter and you've delivered the first version of the specification, the wish list is a great source of information for what might go into the next charter if you want to do that. So it has many advantages. I highly recommend that. So moving on to slide 7, keeping working group on time. So as I said earlier, there's this, we are fighting some expectation that, time is elastic and the charters come up with a rough schedule that means nothing. And the W3C is trying to change this mentality. And as chair, you absolutely, you play a very important role in trying to make the change happen. So as I said, the charter already normally, includes some rough schedule. You can go ahead and further refine this as you move forward. And it's the kind of thing, it's like project management type of activity that a lot of people find annoying and not necessarily very interesting. But I find that this is very important to do. And you cannot, it's up to you how fine-grained you want your schedule and your timeline to be. You probably don't want to go too far. You have to keep in mind that, you can set all the deadline you want. At the end of the day, the working group is not completely under your control. Their people have their own priorities, and you may not be able to enforce them. But at least what you can do is keep the working group informed of where they are. And so I always work with the assumption that the expiration date for the current charter is a deadline that is absolute. It's not something just informative that we can keep, you know, ignoring. And so I always remind people where we are on the charter and on the timeline, you know, towards beginning to delivering the deliverables that are set by the charter. And when you get closer to the deadline, you have to find ways to reduce the scope so that you can still deliver on time, rather than just say, no, it's okay, we'll deliver it later. And so I always look for ways to cut the spec. The smaller the spec is, the easier it becomes to get it done. So it's a good way to do. And then there's a bunch of deliverables that working groups typically want to make, like primers, but they are nice to have, but they are not essential. So anything that is not on the charter, that is not a major deliverable, you should consider cutting, or at least, you know, in your agenda, when you set meetings, etc., you can give them a lower priority. You get to discuss those only if you can afford it, if you have time for this. And so, again, I mean, don't be afraid of being drastic about this and just keep reminding the working group. You have to keep pounding the fact that time is slipping by. And it helps working group, again, maybe you cannot force them, but you know, to do things, but you can force them to face the reality that, you know, we are in. So moving on, slide 8, conducting productive meetings. So that's another thing. You know, as chair, it's really your responsibility. You can play a key role in having productive meetings. There are different aspects that, you know, come into play to achieve that goal. The first one is to try and set a detailed agenda. And it's very hard, you know, especially at the beginning. I find that setting an agenda for like a 2-day meeting is very hard. But I try to, you know, set a very detailed agenda where the breaks are marked, and not just the breaks, but I say, okay, I'm going to dedicate maybe an hour to the primer, an hour to the spec, and then, you know, 2 hours to this issue because it's a major one. And you try to get ballpark, you know, time frame. And you may get it wrong, but it's okay. At least you give yourself some kind of a straw man that allows you to figure out whether you're still on track or not. What you don't want is to have a meeting, you ran for a meeting for 2 days, and then at the end, you're like, oh shoot, we have all these things that we haven't even talked about. It's better to have a detailed agenda that is wrong that you will adjust as you go, because maybe sometimes you say, it'll take us an hour to talk about this, and in 15 minutes, you're done, and you're like, okay, what do we do? Well, you don't go on a break for 45 minutes, obviously, you just readjust your schedule. But it helps people get an expectation of what's going to be discussed, and it helps you keep things on track so that at least you have a certain amount of time dedicated for everything you want to talk about. As you drive the meeting, you really have to do that, drive the meeting. You cannot just manage the queue and, you know, let people talk. You also have to reset the discussion to the topic being talked about. You have to interrupt when people go off for too long. You know, there are people who like to talk, and there is always one of those people, at least in a working group. And, you know, it's your prerogative as the chair to interrupt when it's the case. Because we also have the experience of those people, and everybody else is like, oh my God, this guy will never end. And so as chair, it's your responsibility, and you have the, you know, the prerogative of cutting this off, and everybody will thank you for doing this. So you have to, again, this is part of driving the discussion. It's also very interesting, you know, I find that oftentimes people talk back and forth, and it goes on for quite a while, and it's part of human communication. Communication is hard. Sometimes it's worthwhile for you as chair to take the time to restate the issue at hand and the different positions that you're hearing, and try to see if, you know, by paraphrasing what people are saying, if, you know, it maybe it will you know, get a different reaction. And I find very interesting in those cases where you seem to be, you know, in a deadlock going back and forth over an issue, to turn to those people who are the most quiet. You always have those people in the working groups that are more quiet than others. And it's often interesting in those moments to talk to them and say, hey, John, what do you think, you know? And they may have, by simply prompting them, they may say something and it may, you know, change the atmosphere and people will think about it differently and it may unlock the situation. The killer thing is the open-ended questions. You really want discussions to be as focused as possible. I have seen examples of that where, you know, people talked about, so in the case of the social web working group recently, we're talking about JSON LD, and people start talking about the merit of those things. And it's like, well, you don't want to have this kind of general discussion. You have to say, what would be the benefit of using this technology in our case? And be as specific as possible. You don't want to end up in something very general where people can lecture on the benefit of one technology or something like this for a long time. And as you progress in your group and you have a document, I find the most effective way of making progress is to request issues to be specified around text in the document and to actually make proposals for changes. What would it take for you to, you know, for the issue to be addressed to your liking? And so that helps a lot. You know, drive the discussion and focus on the important things. And again, don't let the most vocal participant really, you know, kind of give a sense of where the working group might be. You have to figure it out yourself. And I've seen many cases where we have very vocal people and they talk so loud, they speak so much, they flood the mailing list that you get a sense that, like, my goodness, the working group is nowhere. We are like all over the map. This is chaos. And then I have a straw poll and I say, hey, how do you guys feel about this issue? Would you think we should do this or that? And you find a straw poll that the person who is the most vocal is completely isolated. The whole working group is actually on the other side. And then it becomes a non-issue. Typically, unless they are really bad people, they will just say, oh, okay, never mind. And so it's very important to have those straw polls. They are very cheap. You do that on your RSC channel. You say it's a straw poll, and you know you actually get a real sense of where the working group is. Don't let you know the amount of email or the amount of talking, you know, imply a certain position in the working group. You have to figure it out by doing those straw poll yourself. And then sometimes it is really worth for you to make the proposal yourself. Don't wait for the working group to make all the proposal. You can make the proposal yourself. And I often have managed to succeed in addressing major issues, like in the LDP working group, for instance, recently, where we had different, you know, groups of people arguing one side or another. And I try to understand what the technical issue was and to come up with a proposal that I thought might work for everybody. And so you have to make a proposal and see where people, what sticks. So let's move on to slide 9, consensus. So I talked about that earlier, and I think most people who are involved in W3C are aware of that. However, I have to say this has been a pet peeve of mine for many years. As I said, I've been working in the standards arena, in the industry in general, and I see the terms consensus being used everywhere. Yet, you know, the way that is typically implemented is very different from what I expect and from what I've learned to do with the W3C. So, I think it's important to understand what it means to actually reach consensus. And so, I'm going to talk a bit more about this. So first, I think the when you make proposal, they need to be as specific as possible. It's very important not to have this kind of like, you know, kind of a wavy general thing. And if possible, that's part of the things that I do in the if I have a teleconference coming up, I will make the proposal in the agenda if I can. Some of them, they will come up during the calls, that's okay. But if you do know beforehand, there's an issue that has been discussed for a while, there's a proposal that seems to be acceptable by most, you say, okay, I'm going to put that on the agenda, and people can, you know, look at it beforehand and get prepared. You need to make sure that when you run the store poll or the proposal vote, you actually, people understand it. I've had the case where, you know, I failed to realize that we had a new person to W3C in the working group, and we were having these votes with minus ones and whatnot, and somebody did a minus one, and we're like, oh, so, you know, everything stops. And we are asking what's going on, and I was like, no, but it's okay, you can go ahead. And he just didn't know that minus one is a veto. It means we are going to stop and take the time to understand what the issue is and what it will take to change that vote. So it's very important, as you, I'm sure you're familiar with, you know, plus one means yes, zero abstain, minus one is a veto. And people use a bunch of variations, but it's more fun than anything else. The thing that is important is only minus one is blocking. If somebody says minus 0.9, that's not minus one, it's not blocking. It just means they don't like it at all, but they still can live with it. So when someone objects, it's very important to say, okay, what do we have to do now? So you have to first ask for an explanation. It's not okay for somebody to just object and not explain. You have to figure out what it would take to address the objection and ask for a counterproposal. I find that very interesting. People object sometimes. They don't like it, but they have nothing else to propose. And when you make them face that, sometimes they will retract their minus one. In case of a deadlock, again, you know, it's a bit like I was talking about earlier, you have to try to come up with proposal. And so sometimes it's useful as chair to even do a little bit of homework on the side. I have been, you know, in some cases, I even pick up the phone and call people individually and I say, hey, how about this? What if we did this way? And by having conversation with people, you know, the main parties that are fighting over a specific issue, you can get a sense of what might actually fly and resolve the issue. And of course, this can be very time consuming, but, you know, this is something that is worth doing in my experience if you're facing major challenges in your working group. Moving to slide number 10. So consensus versus majority. This is an example that shows really why it is different to reach consensus than having a simple majority vote. So I have an example here where we have two proposals. One has a minus one, the other one doesn't. And even though the majority of the people would prefer the one option, you know, versus the other, it's the one that everybody can live with that gets accepted that becomes the consensus. But of course, you know, if you're a case like that where everybody really dislike it, they just agree that they can live with it, you probably still want to try, you know, to address the objection in the first place, because obviously in this case, in proposal A, if you could turn this minus one into just a zero, I abstain, that would be the best, because you have the, you know, what people prefer. But if you really stuck, proposal B is the way to go. And so, again, the key question is, can you live with it? And that's a very different outcome than a simple majority vote. So, which leads to slide number 11, formal objections. So what happens if, you know, you're in a case where there is just no other proposal, there is only one way, and the working group is all in agreement except one person. So once they have objected and you're stuck, you cannot just stay stuck as chair. You need to move on. So you have to inform the objector that basically their recourse at this point is to file a formal objection. At the same time, there is this fear that I've seen in many working groups where people are like, oh my goodness, we're going to have a formal objection. And you should not be afraid of it. The reality is that formal objections are not, you know, should not be used by people to hold the working group hostage. So you need to document, you inform them of their possibility, and you need to document it if they want to, but you need to move on. The reality is that, you know, very few people actually go through the trouble of filing formal objections. Again, it's mostly a way for them to express the discontent, and they want that to be acknowledged, but they are not going to necessarily go beyond that. And even then, even if they do, it's okay. That's not going to necessarily be a showstopper if, you know, you have properly documented how you get to this point. And as chair, your responsibility is to decide when it is the right thing for the working group to override the objection and move forward. Again, you have the responsibility of keeping the working group going, so you have to balance those aspects. Moving on, slide 12, chair's neutrality. So that's, you know, maybe more of a controversial issue. I know that different people, you know, behave differently in this respect. Personally, I find it's much better to be neutral as chair. It kind of makes it easier to, you know, drive the discussion without having, without working group members feeling that you're biased because you have your own agenda. Not all organizations can do that, but ideally, the best thing is to be, when you're the chair, is to have somebody else from your organization represent your organization so you can stay neutral. You don't have to actually do both, you know, being neutral, driving the discussion, and at the same time conveying a specific position from your organization. So practically speaking, when I chair, I never vote, and only consider voting if there's a tie and it helps the working group at that point to decide one way or another. Line number 13, issues and resolutions. A lot of the work that we do ends up being around, you know, identifying issues and addressing them. When you close all your issues, you've done your job. To do that, I find using the tracker, you know, tool that we have for working groups is very helpful. There's different ways you can use tracker. Personally, I find it, you know, efficient to have this process that I lay out with the working group at the beginning, where anybody can raise an issue, and then you can, only the working group can open an issue. So there are different states, right, that an issue can be in. And so as I beginning the teleconference every week, I have this section on tracking actions and issues. And as part of this, we look at the issues that have been raised, and we decide as a group whether the issue is indeed, should, you know, valid and should, is in scope, and therefore whether we should open it or not. Every time you open an issue, you add to the workload of the working group, and so it's something that cannot be done lightly. At the same time, when an issue has been addressed, or at least somebody thinks they have addressed the issue, they can go ahead and mark the issue as pending review. And again, as part of the tracking of options and the issues, you can look at this and decide what needs to be marked as closed. So again, this is something that you need to do on an ongoing basis. And I do that on a weekly basis to keep track of what's going on. You also need to make sure that when you close the issues, you mark, you know, you put a reference to the resolution. A lot of the work that we have to do as chair is keeping track of things, recording things. And so, for instance, you know, the tools that we have on the IRC channel, they allow you to close the issue, but it's not going to mark, you know, put a reference to a resolution. So I, for instance, I go after the calls. When I produce the minutes and everything, I usually go back to the issues and I add a comment where I put a reference saying this was resolved there, and I put a link to the resolution in the minutes so that, you know, later on when people look at the issue, they can see when it was closed, but also where, and have a reference to the resolution. And a very important thing that needs to be done, and, you know, as chair that you need to be aware of, is to not let people reopen issues when there is no new information. That happens all the time. People don't necessarily get issues resolved the way they'd like, so they just try again. They say, oh, but regarding this issue, I would like us to do this and that. Don't let that happen. You really have to put a stop on that. And then, you know, there are different tools that are being used. GitHub is becoming more and more popular. Most working groups now are switching to GitHub. And so you have to figure out exactly how to deal with this. And it's fine, but in terms of process, you know, you should use a similar process anyway. And I know that W3C, the system team, has been working on integrating GitHub to all the other tools that we have, so things will get better on that front. All right, moving on to slide 14, enabling remote and asynchronous participation. This is a really hard topic, and I think anybody who's been involved in W3C for a while knows that it's hard. We keep talking about the different time zones, the different languages of people. I mean, it's hard. But so different groups deal differently with this issue. Some people say, well, we'll make all our decisions by mail. And so there is a delay. You have to say, okay, here's the proposal. Please vote. People send their vote in email, and then there's a deadline on which you say, okay, this is the outcome. I find that too slow and painful. But, you know, I admit that some people say that it works well for them, and that's fine. Personally, what I like the most is to conduct the meetings with the assumption that people who are here are able to make decisions, and then all the decisions are made have to be confirmed the following week. So the way we do that is we produce draft minutes. Resolutions are considered, you know, tentative at that point. And then on the next call, you confirm the minutes. By approving the minutes the next time, you actually confirm the resolution. And that gives a time window during which people can review the minutes and raise objections or, you know, concerns if there is a problem with the resolutions that were made during the call. So I find that quite practical, and people seem to be happy with that way of functioning. So moving on, action items on slide number 15. So again, this has to do a lot with, you know, the fact that you don't have any carrots and sticks as chair, and you're trying to keep track of who's doing what. I find that using the tracker to record actions is useful, but there are, you know, you have to use it well. And so one thing, for instance, that I find very kind of productive that I've seen, sometimes it's done kind of humoristically. People laugh about it. They give actions to people who are not there. In my experience, it's not a very good way. You have to ensure that people understand their action and that they accept it. Otherwise, not very useful. And again, you have to keep track of this on a regular basis. As I said, I do that on the weekly calls at the beginning with tracking of actions and issues, and we go through the list of actions. When people have done the action, they can simply mark it as pending review, and they give them an opportunity at the call to talk about what they've done to complete their action. And, you know, most of the time there's no issue. People agree, and you just close it with consensus from the working group. You don't necessarily have to have a formal proposal for that, by the way. Sometimes, you know, for the simple thing, you can just say, is anybody objecting to closing action X? And, you know, if nobody objects, you can just move on. But so I find that an efficient way of keeping track of what's going on. And one important thing to do is, you know, there's all these actions that tend to stay there for a long time. What I like to do is ask people, what is going on? Is there anything that blocks you from completing this action? It's often, you know, sometimes there is miscommunication. They say, oh, but I was waiting for so-and-so to do this, and the other person doesn't even know they had to do it or they forgot, right? So it's very important to ask them why they are stuck, if they are stuck. Ralph, you want to ask your question now or you want to ask it later?
Well, it's more of a comment than anything else, so thanks, okay. Arno. I wasn't sure if you would want questions during the middle. One technique that I recently proposed and seems to be working well in a group is an idea that comes from New England town meetings, where if there are resolutions or pending review action items that the chair suspects are not at all controversial and won't have any discussion at all. The very first agenda item in the meeting is something that in New England Town Meeting is called the consent calendar. And the chair just groups a set of things that the chair doesn't believe will have any discussion at all, will just be approved as, you know, as proposed, lumps those all into the first agenda item. And when the agenda's sent out before the meeting, anybody who wants to discuss any of those things says, please take action 47 off of the consent calendar. And everything left there is just, you know, the chair just says, the consent calendar is now approved, and you move on.
Okay.
It's a way to identify, and you have to have some agreement up on what sorts of resolutions can be included in the consent calendar. But clearly, any action item that is pending review is a candidate to be there, and the chair just says, you know, we're going to approve all of these, close all of these actions unless somebody specifically wants to discuss them. Anyway.
All right. Sounds interesting indeed. All right. So moving on, slide number 16, developing documents. So, you know, this is typically a very important part of what most working groups do. It's very important to find people who are committed. You need at least, you know, in my experience, it's very helpful to have a couple of editors. But again, you don't want to go overboard in the number of the editors because, again, there is an overhead in just coordinating. So I find that, you know, it seems like two editors seems to be optimal number. You may leave with three, but you probably don't want to go beyond that. But, you know, they need to understand what it means. And sometimes it's hard because if you don't have anybody volunteering, you may have a problem. But they cannot just say, sure, I'll do it, and if they really can't afford the time to do it. So make sure that they understand what it takes to do that. And then, you know, as you move forward, you make sure the working groups are paying attention. There are obviously some very important milestones in the recommendation track that, you know, will be triggers for that. But on an ongoing basis, you also want to, you know, make sure people are paying attention. And, you know, we always have this time when we say, okay, everybody should review the document by next week. But, you know, in my experience, that's not enough. What you want to do is give actions to a couple of people who are really on the hook to do that, so that at least there are two people who are in to do it. So there is also developing a test suite. It's part of the DRPC process. We have to, you know, go through this candidate recommendation during which we gather implementation experience and actually test that the specification achieves the goal of, you know, producing interoperability or enabling interoperability. And I have found that developing a test suite is something we often forget, and we do at the end, and then you kind of get stopped. You have finished the spec and you're ready, but you don't have a test suite, so you cannot move forward, and it gets very frustrating. It's much more wise to actually bring that up early in your group so that this starts being done in parallel to developing the specification. And in fact, when you have issues and you make resolution, they are typically good candidates to develop tests that can be added to the test suite. And sometimes it really helps to actually have a test to look at, because you have an issue and you say, well, is it behaving this way or that way? And people sometimes have a hard time expressing what they want. You put a test together. You say, this is what I mean. You know, when I do this, this is what I expect. And it helps develop the test suite, and it helps, you know, further discussion around closing the issue. So the last piece on this is to be proactive. I have experience, I think a lot of people have done that throughout the history of the DRPC, is that, you know, people have a motivation initially. We start developing something. There are issues, needs that get expressed. And then at the end, maybe, you know, it still takes about 2 years or so to produce a specification. By the end, needs may have changed, their views may have changed, and there may be features in the specification that nobody really cares to implement. And so you want to identify those early on. And there's this system there's this feature in the DRPC process called feature at risk. So you can mark a feature as at risk you signal to the world you're progressing forward, but you have a doubt about a specific feature. The big advantage of doing that is, well, first you highlight that there's an issue, you know, potential issues area that will change in the spec, but you can also withdraw that section from the, or the feature from the specification without having to go back on the process track. So, you know, I've learned the hard way that sometimes failing to identify those things will incur, delay later on. So, don't hesitate. Of course, you don't want to label the whole spec as feature at risk because that kind of defeats the purpose. But, you know, if there are certain aspects that should be labeled as such, it's good to do so. Moving on to slide 17, publishing documents. I'm going to say much on this, but it's obviously an essential part of the JRPC process. What I find is that it's always a source of a bit, a frustration for the editors. For the first editors that have not gone through this process of JRPC, it's kind of a struggle. There is a lot of information that you need to put together to actually publish the document. It's more than just saying, hey, here's my file, just go put it, in the TR space at JRPC. There are rules about what it takes, and there are tests that need to be passed. And again, as chair, you are kind of by default the person who is going to be in charge and helping make that happen. Again, the team contact should also help you there, but this is something you really should get involved in. You need to be familiar with what it takes, and I find that I have to do a lot of education, helping the new editors never gone through this process understand what it's going to take to go through this process. Slide number 18, dealing with comments. So I said it from the start, right? The JRPC is really peculiar in that we're trying very hard to reach to the public at large and make sure that everybody's opinion is taken into account. So, which doesn't mean we agree with everything, but, we have to hear everyone. So this is something that also needs to be part of your normal process. You need to make sure that you reach out and you know the stakeholders and you make sure that they are aware of the progress you're making with the specification. And there are ways that you can try and keep track of the comments. And there is a tool, LastCall Tracker. LastCall has kind of disappeared now, but in fact, it's only on paper because you still have to demonstrate that you had wide review. You still need to go do all the work of making sure that, public comments are being addressed and commenters are satisfied with the response from the working group. And so, again, this is something you need to work out and help the working group figure out how to do and make sure that they do it, because what happens is when you want to move the specification, you have to fill out this transition request and you have to go on their 3M calls and explain what you did. And what you don't want to be in is the situation where you don't have, the answers to the questions and you have not documented. And so you need to document all the things you do so that you can show to the JRPC management that you have done your homework and due diligence has been done. So I'm going to finish with slide number 19, parting thoughts. In the end, I think I always say that people ask me what it's like to work in the JRPC and standards arena in general. I always say it's both very frustrating and very rewarding. So there are many aspects as chair that you don't control. And, it can be very frustrating. There are people sometimes, they disappear, you don't really know why. They have their own priorities. They work for a different organization. They do that sometimes, there is a level of commitment that is expected from the charter, but, people take that more or less seriously. There is a number of comments that come. You just have to deal with them. And sometimes it can be very disruptive. Way into candidate recommendation. You think you're almost there. And then also then somebody comes up with something, you somehow missed, and now you're reconsidering everything, or it can incur a lot of delay, because things came up late. And it doesn't matter how often you ping people, sometimes people don't, you know, for whatever reason, they're not paying attention until very late in the process. And then, you know, you have to deal with this. At the same time, you know, you can mitigate a lot of the things. You can actually, you know, like I said, effectively drive your meetings, drive the discussion. And when things don't seem to be working out very well, you need to get out, you know, maybe try to contact people on the side and figure out where the positions are, where their needs are. If they disappear, like if you have an editor, for instance, who is disappearing, you may want to actually reach out to them individually to try and find out if there's a problem. Maybe you need to find another editor because they took some other responsibility, they can't afford it, etc. So, you know, you have to do these things, and it helps, you know, keeping things under control. So, again, there's a lot of things you don't control, and then there are things you do control. So what's a pity is not to use those things, because you can mitigate a lot of those, you know, things by just what you do and how you run the working group and the meetings. So that's the opportunity you don't want to miss. You know, if you do your part, at least, you know, you can help in a big way. So that completes my presentation. Actually, we're right about out of time. I can stay a few more minutes if people have some questions. And, you know, feel free to reach out later on. I am quite experienced, as I said, with chairing working groups. And if you have particular, you know, situations you want to discuss with me, I'm happy to help if I can. And I should acknowledge on the, you know, on the, my last slide, I put some links to some reading material, and I wanted to acknowledge Joseph Riegel that Ralph knows. And, you know, as I was preparing those slides, I was looking for different material online, and I found this page that Joseph Riegel had put together several years ago, and I was amazed how, you know, how relevant it still was. So I highly recommend you read this if you have a chance. All right, I guess we'll leave it at this. Thank you all for joining.